This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, mounting tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. Tensions between North Korea, formerly called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and the United States have been rising in the past several months. While an increased strain in relations between the two nations have flared periodically in the past, some are calling this particular escalation in tensions troubling in view of recent events. U.S. concerns center over what has been called an increase of North Korean aggressiveness, including the growing threat of North Korea's ramped-up nuclear weapons program. In response, President Trump has deployed the supercarrier USS Carl Vinson Strike Group to the Korean Peninsula, where it has been conducting military exercises with South Korean and Japanese forces. The U.S. has also been setting up a controversial missile defense system in South Korea, which have irritated not only North Korea, but its key ally, China. Despite this string of events that has pushed relations between the U.S. and North Korea to alarming levels, so far it has been mostly tough talk between both sides. The White House even recently said that there's still room for a diplomatic resolution to the situation. So, can this escalation of tensions with North Korea be resolved peacefully, or could it end up with conflict? With us today to analyze the possibilities and the balance of power on the peninsula are two distinguished analysts, Frank Januzzi, president and CEO of the Mansfield Foundation, a nonprofit organization based here in Washington, which promotes cooperation between the United States and Asia. And also joining us is Dean Cheng, senior research fellow at the Asian Studies Center of the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank also based in Washington. Dean, Frank, thanks for joining us today and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
Let's start from the beginning. Let's look at the recent events in the rise of tensions between the U.S. and North Korea. Prominently, what comes to mind is that President Trump sent some warships, including the USS Vincent Strike Group, to the Korean Peninsula. And, of course, the installation of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, in South Korea. Frank, let's start with you. What do you think led up to this current situation where we're at such a high level of tension with North Korea?
Well, the root cause of the crisis that we're experiencing now is North Korea's continued development of nuclear weapons and long-range ballistic missiles. Specifically, their repeated testing of missiles of various ranges, contrary to a very clear UN Security Council resolutions that make such tests illegal, has certainly gotten Trump's attention and gotten the international community's attention and heightened the tensions. I think what makes the certain situation right now a bit different in the past is mostly because we have a new U.S. president. Other aspects of this problem look very familiar to me and to others who observe the peninsula. Not much has changed over the last 8 years.
And Dean, your thoughts?
I would agree that this is a chronic problem. This is not an acute problem, although it's much more in the news at the moment. But it is worth considering that as North Korea pushes ahead with developing an ICBM, one of the great fears and concerns, both in this administration and the previous several administrations, is that a North Korea that had no problem assassinating most of the South Korean cabinet, repeated attempts to assassinate the South Korean president, and more recently this sinking of a South Korean warship on the high seas, when a North Korea is willing to do that when it can't hold the United States at risk, what might it be willing to try once it does develop an ICBM and a nuclear warhead that will fit on top?
Recently, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence visited the militarized zone that separates North and South Korea, and he warned that the era of strategic patience is over. Frank, can you tell us what is strategic patience and how has it been applied to U.S.-North Korea relations?
Well, you know, when the Obama administration came into office, they wanted to break what they thought was a cycle of North Korean provocation, U.S. engagement through diplomacy, a brief period of calm followed by additional North Korean bad behavior. And so they really tried to lay down a marker that North Korea needed to prove its sincerity about its desire to consider denuclearization before they were going to be prepared to engage. And they called this, the shorthand of this was strategic patience. The Trump administration is already learning that there's really no alternative to strategic patience on the peninsula. Dean is right that North Korea's development of an ICBM would certainly significantly alter the situation. But North Korea is not suicidal. And the United States has no good military options on the peninsula. Only a negotiated approach can advance our security and hopefully put the peninsula on a path toward denuclearization and peace. So all new presidents have to disavow the name of the previous president's foreign policy. I'm sure they'll come up with Trump patience or Trump strategy, but it's going to look a lot like what Obama has done.
Dean, to you, what do you think the vice president meant when he said the era of strategic patience is over?
Actually, there are a surprising number of options. And in particular, there is this myth, frankly, that North Korea is the most sanctioned country on earth. And as my colleague Bruce Klingner is fond of pointing out, until very recently, as in the last few weeks, there were more sanctions on Zimbabwe than there were on North Korea. So I think that in saying that the era of strategic patience is over, and when we look at similar comments from Secretary of State Tillerson, what we see is an effort to now put into play a lot of economic measures. For example, North Korea's banks are now basically excluded from the International Financial Transaction Network, SWIFT. This is unprecedented. No previous administration has pushed as far as this administration already has in the last few weeks. There remain a lot of North Korean entities that can be sanctioned, and frankly, there are secondary sanctions that could be applied, for example, against Chinese banks or firms that are cooperating, frankly, with North Korea.
Frank, do you think that there's a possibility that Kim Jong-un will stay true to his word and follow through with any military threats, any military action against U.S. or South Korea or Japan or even, I'm hearing, Australia?
Well, it's important to view the context of those threats. It's always North Korea saying that if they are subjected themselves to a U.S. attack or if they see a U.S. preemptive attack coming, that they won't sit around and allow the U.S. to strike the first blow. North Korea is a rational actor. 70 years on the peninsula, deterrence works. On sanctions, I think I have a slightly different view than Dean. There's lots of headroom to tighten sanctions on North Korea. That's true. But North Korea is essentially a cash economy and has been for years. Every foreign embassy that is based in Pyongyang, every major trading company does business essentially by cash, not wire transfer SWIFT systems. So while it certainly could complicate some of their financing, I don't think that those additional financial measures are going to really bite. China doesn't want to pull the plug on North Korea. They don't want to cause the collapse of North Korea. So while I think sanctions are a really important part of a diplomatic strategy, they can bring some pressure to bear. Sanctions alone are not going to get the job done. And what we really need is maybe not strategic patience, because I think that didn't work, but we need patient strategy.
Dean, we're talking about sanctions, and a lot of critics of sanctions say they haven't worked in the past. Why would they work now?
Well, it's interesting that people will say that they haven't worked in the past when, as I said, North Korea has not, in fact, been subject to the full array of sanctions. On the financial aspect, for example, and while I agree with Frank that much of North Korea's business is done in cash, at the end of the day, at some level, they do want to be able to transfer money around, even if it's just for their own purposes, like, for example, bringing money back from embassies and things like that. So in 2005 was the last time anybody actually tried to sanction a bank associated with North Korea, the Banco Delta Asia, based in Macau. Sanctions were placed for literally only a few months and then were suspended. So people who claim that sanctions have been applied and don't work, they need to answer which sanctions do they think have been applied.
Speaking of sanctions, would it be unilateral, in other words, the U.S. applying the sanctions, or does it have to be international, Frank?
Well, there's a great advantage whenever the United States can mobilize unanimity at the U.N. Security Council, as they did with U.N. Security Council Resolution 2321 last fall. Obama went to the U.N. Security Council. He got the most comprehensive sanctions to date imposed on North Korea, including, importantly, a quota on coal exports from North Korea. Whenever the international community can speak with one voice, it helps diplomatically and in terms of the actual impact of the sanctions. It helps diplomatically because North Koreans cannot claim that this is just the, you know, imperialist aggressive forces, which is what they call the U.S. and the Japanese, South Koreans. And it helps in terms of impact because, again, China's number one economic partner of the North. And if China's not on board, then the U.S. can cut off everything, and it's not going to really matter.
Speaking of international cooperation and speaking with one voice, as Frank said, let's look at a couple of key nations that may be playing a role in this, and that, of course, is China and Russia. I mean, they've got votes on the UN that could stop anything. Your thoughts on how they're looking at the situation?
With regards to China, I think it's very important to recognize that China's view of North Korea is very different from that of the United States, South Korea, and Japan. For the Western countries, U.S., Japan, South Korea, our biggest concern is North Korea's nuclear capability. North Korea regularly says we will turn Seoul into a sea of flames. If you're the Chinese, your concern is not about North Korean nuclear weapons because, frankly, they're not targeting Beijing. Mm-hmm. It is the prospect of collapse, as Frank said, and therefore millions of refugees crossing the Yalu. So right there you have a fundamental asymmetry of interests, which is going to influence what their respective policies will then be with regards to North Korea. With the Russians, it's even harder to fathom because, of course, the Russian Far East is very far from Moscow, and Russia's ties to the entire region are very limited. So Russia, unfortunately, seems to be more intent on playing the role of spoiler than anything else.
Mm-hmm. I read a news report that they're alleging that Russia deployed troops toward North Korea. Of course, Russian military is denying it.
I've heard that. I've also seen other reports that said that the Chinese have deployed troops on their border. And again, the Chinese foreign minister, I believe, has also denied that. Realistically, given the growth in tension, it wouldn't be surprising if the militaries of both countries were on a higher state of alert, which would probably mean people moving out of their barracks and out to the field, because no one right now is sure where this crisis is going to end. And it would be only prudent for countries that are literally sitting on the border of this situation to be ready for any possible contingency.
Looking at the situation in North Korea and the U.S., over the past several weeks, Kim Jong-un has been leading various celebrations to mark occasions in North Korea's history with displays of their military weaponry and prowess. And to me, from what I've seen, it reminded me of the old May Day parades in Moscow during the Cold War. And according to the state-run Korean Central News Agency, Kim Jong-un supervised what it calls its largest ever live-fire military drill recently. They look pretty intimidating.
Well, this is a case where historical perspective is very, very important. I began my career in government as a military analyst at the State Department looking at North Korea and Northeast Asia. And we are in the culminating week of the traditional North Korean joint field military exercises. And the parades to mark important anniversaries have been going on through the central square there that I've visited in Pyongyang really since the founding of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So these are important because they demonstrate Kim Jong-un fully assuming the mantle of leadership. He's in year six of his administration. He's becoming more comfortable in his role. He's purged or gotten rid of several potential rivals or adversaries or troublemakers, as he saw them. And he's flexing his muscle, I believe, both to demonstrate the legitimacy of his government at home, but also to signal the new U.S. administration and the upcoming new South Korean administration that he's not to be taken lightly. Of note, I would say, you know, this parade featured either mock-ups or missile canisters of at least a couple of new classes of missiles, what appeared to be solid fuel, long-range missiles. I think this is a good indication of where the DPRK is headed.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Today, we're discussing the rising tensions between North Korea, the U.S., and its allies. My guests today are Frank Januzzi, President and CEO of the Mansfield Foundation, and Dean Cheng, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Now, we've been talking, gentlemen, about the growing nuclear program that North Korea has been developing. Dean, can you give us an update? Where are they standing? Are they capable of launching a strike against the U.S. or any of its allies?
North Korea has staged at least five nuclear tests. So at this point, we in the West are fairly confident that they have the ability to manufacture at least atomic weapons. The North Koreans have claimed that they have developed fusion bombs, hydrogen bombs. That is a claim that is greeted with much more skepticism. North Korea has a variety of missiles at the medium range, intermediate range, which can certainly reach South Korea, which you don't need that kind of range. Japan and almost certainly Guam. So again, we think that at this point, if they're not there yet, they're probably literally within a year or so of developing a warhead that can fit on top of that. At one point, there's a photograph of something jokingly referred to as the disco ball, which is a mock-up of a nuclear-type warhead. The ICBM part is, of course, what has gotten a lot of attention. The canisters that were displayed are supposedly for an ICBM. Whether or not North Korea has the ability to miniaturize a warhead that could reach the U.S. is not clear at this point, but I don't think any expert would say, one, that they can't do it. This is a matter of engineering and basic physics, and two, that they won't be able to do it within, say, 3 years. So whether or not they can reach Seattle, Chicago, or Washington is a matter of time, not a matter of fundamentally capability.
Frank, I was reading reports based on what Dean was just saying, that supposedly rumors have it that two of the missiles, the ICBMs that North Korea is working on, supposedly has in its arsenal, one can reach the west coast of the United States, and the second, alarmingly, can actually reach the east coast. Do you see any validity in that?
If I may, as fascinating as it is to chronicle the mile-by-mile expansion of their ballistic missile threat, you know, really the solutions that we need to pursue on the Korean Peninsula are lasting peace, denuclearization. And to pursue those, we need to have a holistic agenda that goes far beyond just halting their testing of ICBMs or their testing of nuclear weapons. Unless we are prepared to go to war with North Korea in order to compel their surrender, what we're talking about is an end game that involves a negotiation. And in a negotiation, both parties have to get something they want. We should be asking the question, what does North Korea want? I think the answer is respect and security. They currently see nuclear weapons as a pathway to both. And it seems to me that our job is to find ways to substitute other things, whether it's security guarantees from China, whether it's diplomatic recognition, to provide them with the respect and the security that they need in order for them to comply with what we need. We need them to fully, completely, verifiably denuclearize. So I think we should focus on that. They will at some point develop an ICBM on their current path.
We've been basically talking about North Korea themselves deploying nuclear weapons. Dean, what about through back channels? I mean, what if North Korea exports their nuclear technology to other countries? I know they supposedly have a good relationship with Pakistan. You know, what if these nukes got into terrorist groups' hands, for example?
Well, this is a very real concern. North Korea has demonstrably exported every single weapon it has developed. It has had no compunction, for example, with apparently supplying the Syrian regime with at least chemical weapons precursors, and some reports have indicated both sarin and VX, both of which are nerve agents, and of course that has been in the news as well. Mm-hmm. They did, in fact, apparently export parts of a nuclear reprocessing facility to Syria.
It was a reactor, I think, but actually a nuclear power reactor. Yeah.
Which the Israelis, fortunately for us, took out. But again, this is not the sort of regime that would seem to have too many compunctions about not exporting either nuclear material, nuclear know-how, or nuclear weapons. In some odd ways, it almost resembles Blofeld's Spectre from the James Bond novels. The other thing to keep in mind here is this is a regime that is strapped for cash. And North Korean embassies abroad have been charged with everything from manufacturing methamphetamines to counterfeiting American currency at such a high level of quality that they're called super hundreds because they are very hard to distinguish from actual American currency. Again, a regime that's willing to engage in fundamentally criminal activity, why wouldn't it be willing to export nuclear material for large amounts of badly needed cash?
Well, while I largely agree with Dean on this point, let me say that, you know, to me it also goes to the question of if we leave North Korea only illicit economic activities to generate cash for the regime because of the imposition of sanctions on things like coal. One of the things we're doing is essentially moving them more and more into the zone where they would be tempted to export fissile material, uranium enrichment technologies, or other nuclear material and know-how that they have garnered through hard work over the last 30-plus years. So, again, the end game here should be to shut down their illicit economic activities, the counterfeiting, the drug manufacturing, methamphetamines, the supernotes, in order to have them generate a real economy, but one which is playing by the international rules and one which isn't feeding resources into a nuclear weapons program. So what Dean says is right. The proliferation threat, to me, is actually of higher concern right now than the risk that North Korea would launch an attack. That keeps me up at night.
Dean, are you saying this is basically financial in nature, the situation?
No, I'm saying that there is a financial aspect to all of this. The problem is that there is very little evidence, if any, that the Kim family, which has been in charge, so Grandpa Kim Il-sung, Dad Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un, are in fact interested in the economic reforms that are fundamentally necessary if North Korea is going to stand up. We have a regime whose economy is in collapse, and while some of it may be due to sanctions, a lot of it is due to fundamental mismanagement and a system that has basically driven its own system over a cliff.
But with respect, I would disagree with your assessment, Dean, about where North Korea is economically. I was speaking with a Western ambassador based in Pyongyang just yesterday. North Korea is not in economic collapse. The capital city of Pyongyang, which, you know, some people point out, and I've been there three or four times, it's true that the capital city is completely different than the rest of the country, but it constitutes about 2.5 million people and all of the elite, and their livelihoods and their economics matters. Capital city is booming. There are more cars on the streets than ever. They have traffic jams in Pyongyang now. They have new residences. They have 2 million cell phone users in Pyongyang. This is a new development. North Korea's economy is growing. And the reason it's growing, even under sanction, is because of the economic adjustments that have been made by Kim Jong-un. Marketizing agricultural production, allowing farmers to keep a significant share of their production and sell it in markets. This is new in the last 10 years. They're also reforming industrial enterprises and putting them on a more commercial footing. So I would take issue with the idea that this is an economy in a collapse or a leadership that has no interest in economic reform. If there's any hope for a solution on the peninsula, it's in enticing them further down the path of marketization, market economics, because that maximizes our soft power and leverage. As long as they're a command economy with everyone getting fed by the government and everyone getting their houses from the government, the likelihood that there's going to be change there is very low.
One issue that I didn't bring up in our conversation, gentlemen, that I want to mention now is the issue over the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, in South Korea. And a lot of opposition to that, specifically Moon Jae-in, who is a presidential candidate. From what I understand, he has a 10% lead in the polls leading up to the presidential election on May the 9th. So what do you see, Dean, as the future for THAAD?
Well, that's a vital question, because THAAD is being deployed in order to protect both American and South Korean forces against North Korean missiles. That is the purpose of the system. It is designed to counter medium-range missiles, that and which is what the North Koreans are threatening South Korea and Japan with. A failure to implement a policy that was negotiated arduously between the ROK and the United States would call into question the alliance. It would basically confirm all of President Trump's worst instincts with regards to burden sharing, alliance commitment, firmness of alliances, etc. It would also open the door almost immediately to a giant wedge from North Korea, which would exploit this immediately in terms of any daylight between the two. It also, and this is the understated aspect of this, the Chinese have been vehement and vociferous in their opposition to THAAD. Their arguments from a technical perspective are simply wrong. They claim that this will somehow intercept Chinese much longer range missiles. But what it is in fact, China is making a play to South Korea saying, whose side are you on, America's or China's? And to the extent that it is making these arguments, it is saying South Korea must sacrifice its own security to allay Chinese concerns. Essentially saying, South Koreans, you should be willing to give up some of your security to make me, China, feel better. That's a remarkable ask. And for South Korea to cave on this will have repercussions for South Korean relations with China as well as with the United States for decades.
That's the end of this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Frank Januzzi, President and CEO of the Mansfield Foundation, and Dean Cheng, Senior Research Fellow at the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank Anya Zaleski for booking our guests. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.